Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Alva.
And I'm Stephen.
And on today's New Statesman podcast, we discuss the Conservative Party conference and Boris Johnson's speech. And then our special correspondent, Sophie McBain, joins us to speak about her expose of rape culture in British schools. So Stephen and Alva are back from Manchester, looking a little haggard, if you don't mind me saying.
We have seen some stuff, okay?
Like, I mean, you didn't have a hotel room when you arrived, as I heard.
I'm actually so gutted about this because people have been coming up to me during conference and saying, you look surprisingly perky considering, you know, the few days that you've had. And I say, oh, it's my industrial strength concealer. But clearly it's failed to work today.
Sorry, I am actually being misleading to our listeners. You both look
beautiful,
glowing. You're lighting up the studio.
No, I think fair enough. Definitely haggard on the inside.
So as listeners will know, we were very surprised at the quality of our hotel in Brighton. It was a very nice hotel. Of course, inevitably, the universe had to rebalance itself because, you know, what's the opposite of a really good hotel? Not, you might think, a bad hotel. It's actually no hotel. So after several 4 hours of trying to find a hotel, yeah, Alva sending a lot of emails, me spending a lot of time on hold to the emergency travel people, a terrifying 5 minutes when they tried to charge the cost of these emergency hotels to my own card, where it was a bit like, whoa. We ended up, and this also was particularly painful because long-term podcast listeners will appreciate this, in a Novotel.
Oh, that's not bad.
Even Anoush doesn't get it. Your two podcast co-hosts don't even get this podcast reference.
Okay, so way back in the dawn of time when we first had adverts, we had adverts for Novotel.
This was before my time, I think.
So this thing, in addition to feeling tired and old because I'd spent ages, when I was like, and it's a Novotel, and Alva was just like, and what? It's like, oh God, I've lived too long. But long-term listeners will remember that we had adverts for Novotel. And obviously every product we advertise we feel enthusiastic and full of support for. But I actually do really like Novotel. So it was I like the fact that you have this feeling you really could be anywhere in them. They have that kind of magical hotel quality thing going on.
They're the safe option. They're the McDonald's of the hotel world.
Well, as someone who wasn't allowed McDonald's as a child, I do every conference end up going to them in this kind of sort of like, no one can stop me.
I'm an adult now.
I'm an adult, yeah. No consequences. Who cares about the rainforests, Mom? Who cares? I'm going to have a McNugget.
All right. Well, tell me a bit about the mood of the conference before we talk about Boris Johnson's speech. Alva?
You know, I had a brilliant time. It was just so interesting. It actually, even though it was tiring and we spent day one trying to secure a hotel, it actually was just a reminder of why we do this job, because it is just the best way of getting an insight into the mood and the thinking within the governing party. And there's really nothing like it, even when you're sitting in Westminster, just the number of Conservatives that you can speak to back to back. You can kind of take the temperature in a completely different way. Mm. So I think that the main thing that struck me is something that we have been saying on the podcast before, but it just sort of overwhelmed me at this conference, which is just the sheer pragmatism of Conservatives. I think I had so many interesting conversations with very thoughtful Tories, lots of whom listened to this podcast, including one who let me into a party I wasn't invited to because he was on the door. He said, "Oh, Alvaro, I know you from the podcast, so thank you to you. I told you you'd get a shout out and here it is." But I had so many interesting conversations with very thoughtful Conservatives who have various concerns about the direction of the party under Boris Johnson. Lots of people who don't really like him, who feel like they are kind of straying from their ideological values under him, but kind of feel like they need to stick with him because he's popular. But, you know, like concerns in every direction and very well thought through. Also, all the pro-Europeans who are still in the party, still feeling alienated, but still there. It was really interesting, I think, as a demonstration of the thoughtfulness and all the thinking going on behind the scenes, especially the concerns over the national insurance rise, this bigger trend of you know, the Conservatives becoming the party of tax and spend, as a lot of them see it. But then this sense that still they want to stick with Boris Johnson, and then that speech, which I know we'll come on to, just this huge reinforcement of this idea that Boris Johnson is absolutely king, you know, for all that you can tap into the, you know, the whispers around who might succeed him and the different people kind of trying to bolster support for themselves, people like Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, who are quite popular. It's still very much his party. He has this enormous grip on it. This probably wasn't so obvious to people watching from home, but all the cabinet ministers had to deliver their speeches within the conference centre. So there was a sort of corner of the conference centre, you know, where they have all the stalls for the different charities and businesses and so on, a corner with a podium set up and sort of seats set out for the cabinet ministers to deliver their speeches. And it was quite small and they were competing with the noise of the conference centre. And then Boris Johnson had his own huge purpose-built auditorium, sort of Trump style. And also cabinet ministers were quite limited in how long they could speak for and limited in terms of the policy announcements that they could make. One MP was saying, you know, how striking it is that all the cabinet ministers refer to him as the boss. Mm-hmm. And this real sense that everyone is rowing in behind Boris Johnson despite all of these concerns. I mean, you wrote, Stephen, that this could be the high water mark of Johnsonism. I think we probably will look back on this conference, the first one that they've had since they won in 2019 with that huge majority. I think we'll look back on this as the sort of the high point of Boris Johnson's tenure, of this quite remarkable moment where there are so many concerns about where the country is at the moment and also how he differs with his party. And yet everyone was just so completely behind him and the mood was still quite buoyant. It was just fascinating.
Yeah, Stephen, tell us a bit about that, because you concluded that the party was sort of on board with Boris Johnson, but not necessarily Johnsonism.
They are just genuinely the most interesting of the four major parties in Great Britain. Yeah, internally, I mean, right? They just have a lot more going on from a sort of, they can't be very neatly split into easily defined tribes. There's a lot going on underneath the surface. But one of the interesting things is you have loads of MPs who have personal doubts about him, but they have an awful lot of certainty about why their majority is the size it is. And then you have loads of activists who have loads and loads of doubts about the policy program that they are committed to, but they love him. And it was this thing where he started his conference speech with a comment about, you know, the corduroy communist cosmonaut. Yeah, Corbyn, who he didn't name. And you could feel everyone who's had to cover a Boris Johnson speech. I say this despite the fact I did, as I always do, not watching the conference hall. But you could feel this shudder from every journalist. To like, oh, well, this shtick really still. And several Conservative MPs who remain nameless to just like, this is a bit play the hits, isn't it? But they loved it, right? The audience loved it. They loved his jokes. But the interesting thing is every time he did one of his, like, of course we have to raise taxes to deal with this public funding thing, of course we had to do this stuff on the NHS, they did this much more kind of, we understand that we have to clap because it's our party and we're on TV. And the interesting thing is the most genuine applause line was the one which clearly Boris himself didn't see coming and the speechwriter didn't see coming, because he stepped on the applause line, which is he went, yeah, the vaccine's because of capitalism. And they loved that.
It was capitalism that ensured we had a vaccine in less than a year. And the answer, therefore, is not to attack the wealth creators, it's to encourage them, because they are responsible for the aggregate increase in the country's wealth that enables us to make those Pareto improvements and to level up everywhere. And To rub home my point.
That was the most sort of spontaneous bit. Now, of course, parties do move towards their leader over time because people who don't like the direction leave and people who like it join. So it may be in 10 years' time the party grassroots likes this stuff as opposed to just liking the leader. But it is interesting how you basically have this instrumental relationship with the parliamentary party where loads of them are like, not sure about him, but it works electorally. And a large chunk of the grassroots are like, not sure about this programme, but I like him. I find it hard to see how this, well, we won't look at this as the high watermark for him personally, regardless, right? Because obviously what he hopes is he's got his loyal people in big posts now. They will deliver for him. But of course, if they do deliver, they will become more powerful, right? Why is Liz Truss currently in the box seat for the Conservative leadership? Because she's been a successful trade minister. Why is Rishi the second favourite? Because he has a successful pandemic. And obviously we don't need to get into the various debates about that on this one. That's an issue for another time. If the delivery ministers fail, then the government will be in trouble. But if the delivery ministers succeed, then, of course, they will be forces in their own right. Whereas at the moment, they are all in different ways wholly owned subsidiaries of the boss. Of course, if it doesn't work, then it's the high watermark for other reasons. But it was a very interesting conference. Huge levels of joy at the win. But, yeah, definitely, yeah, anxiety over net zero, where the socially acceptable way for people to say that they basically don't believe in it is to go, what about the cost? And then people with real concerns about the level of the tax burden.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to bore listeners with my reflections on it because I wasn't there. But what trickled out to me was slightly jarring sort of triumphalist tone from the conference with what's actually happening in real life in terms of inflation. And this is the first month that energy bills have gone up, reflecting the price of gas and the UC cut, which came in on the day of Boris Johnson's speech. So I wondered whether or not it felt like a parallel universe at all, or whether that stuff was an underlying anxiety.
It did. There was fringe after fringe about, for example, those anxieties around tax and spend. There was a very interesting fringe event with organised by the Taxpayers Alliance, where they had a very thoughtful conversation about the need for some tax increases, but also their concerns and you know, about how ultimately they want to recommit to a small state. And at the end of the hour, the person I was with and I turned to each other and said, you know, there was no mention of the cost of living crisis, fuel prices. And when you're talking about fiscal policy and about the economy, it was, and that happened at every event. I think there was only one passing reference to the current issues in Boris Johnson's own speech. I think he said that there could be some difficulties, or a phrase like that. But that was really all that he touched on. So I felt like Boris Johnson's speech made more sense in the context of the conference than in the wider world. I got home and my flatmate was saying that she didn't really get it because, you know, she's very worried about fuel prices and so on. It made sense in the internal context because I think that party really wanted a victory rally for 2019. And if they were going to have a moment to celebrate this leader who's incredibly popular, with a caveat that, you know, we could go into later. He's relatively popular, but not incredibly popular, I suppose. But if they wanted to have a moment to celebrate him and that victory, then this was the time to do it. But it is a huge gamble, which again is just fascinating, because this framing of labour shortages as sort of all part of the grand plan, this transition to a high-wage, high-productivity economy driven by labour shortages and rising costs is, I think, not just an area of concern for the Labour Party and, you know, people in business and external critics, but a lot of internal critics. I think that's what's really fascinating, that Boris Johnson has really leaned into this line and made it a big part of his speech, but there are big concerns over it. I mean, it was described by the Adam Smith Institute today as economically illiterate, and you just sort of wonder whether that will work for him.
It's sort of his comfort zone, isn't it, taking pot shots at businesses, or at least representatives of British business from the Brexit campaign. And you did have a lot of voices after his speech coming out from the business world criticising it. But really, you know, if he's in his comfort zone doing this, does it eventually collide with the reality that actually businesses don't have what they need in order to recruit people on higher wages to the extent that they need to sort of get us through winter?
This is the thing I found very interesting about it, because occasionally at dinners with ministers or MPs or SPADs, the sort of subject of the stuff that was going outside would, you know, intrude. And people go like, oh, and the polls aren't moving. So, you know. And then, yeah, the conversation would therefore kind of turn to, you know, the problems of the Labour Party and why people thought that was. Now, maybe they're right, and the reason why the polls haven't moved is to do with, you know, a variety of problems with the Labour Party, and then these things won't change overnight. But I do think then there's this kind of weird dissonance. Yeah, there are some Conservative MPs who will kind of quietly drop their voices and go, I just feel like things are about to get quite bad for us. Because, yeah, people keep saying, oh, why isn't the fuel crisis affecting the government? Well, it's just like, actually, in real terms, right, the fuel crisis, the way it manifests itself is you have to queue for ages to get petrol, but in the end, you do still have petrol. Ditto, like, the kind of weird, what I think of as, like, the sort of small Brexitings that keep happening in various supermarkets or at Greggs or whatever, where there's like, yeah, sorry, we don't have any of that in. You do still, in the end, leave Greggs with something. When they keep going, oh, well, when people pay more for HGV drivers, it's like, yes, and at that point, you will leave the supermarket with less. Either less money in your pocket or less in your shopping basket because you literally can't afford it. I got back because, you know, my partner does all of the, like, finance stuff because, you know, she's, like, basically from Tory Britain. So she has all that money-saving expert Martin Lewis stuff. And at the start of the crisis, I was like, who are we with? You know, what the joint account? And she's like, don't worry your pretty little head about it. But she can't, but Martin Lewis has emailed all of, you know, his followers. And as you know, having interviewed him, Anoush, the man has a lot of devoted followers going, yeah, we can't provide you this energy bill saving thing because we think these companies are going to collapse. And basically, everyone on that email is either, you know, someone from, like, those swing seats in the West Midlands who ultimately decide the government, or they're people who really desperately need to save money who, again, will decide the next government. And I think that there's this real kind of failure, you know, not just among MPs, but among a lot of journalists as well, to reckon with the fact that what we're seeing at the moment is the inconvenience bit of the shortage. But actually it being resolved resolves itself in a way which will be really difficult for people on lower and middle incomes, and therefore one would anticipate probably quite difficult for the government.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So we're now joined by our special correspondent, Sophie McBain, who's written the cover story of The New Statesman this week. The headline is The Reckoning, and it's about rape culture and the crisis of misogyny in British schools. And she's joined us to discuss what she's discovered. Sophie, how did you come across this story and why did you think that it was worth exposing?
Well, over the spring and summer, a social media campaign called Everyone's Invited had started gathering testimonies, ultimately from tens of thousands of students attesting to rape culture in British schools. And then I noticed that Colchester Royal Grammar School, which is one of the highest achieving state schools in the country academically, had been downgraded over its safeguarding failures. And that happened after a student called Scarlett Mansfield, a former student at the school, had spoken out about the abuse she experienced and collected over 200 testimonies from other students. And so I really wanted to look at what was happening at this particular school to try to understand what the impact is, what happens when young people speak out about what happened to them at school. And I think the thing I found is that the situation is more urgent and more desperate than I had even realised, and also more complicated.
Okay, and so what was Scarlett and her peers' experience of misogyny at that school?
So Scarlett had kept a diary of her time at school, and in this diary, which she showed to me, she described lots of cases of harassment and bullying by other students, but also that one of her friends locked her in a car and forced her to give him oral sex, and another friend raped her. And lots of these other testimonies, there were hundreds of stories of sexist jokes going unaddressed, racist jokes going unchallenged, but also these dozens of first-person accounts of sexual assault or rape by fellow pupils.
And there's a horrible story, isn't there, where she hadn't actually realised what had happened to her in her assault. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, and this is actually a pattern that seems to happen a lot, that it's really hard for any victim of sexual assault, but especially when it's young people, to necessarily be able to recognise that what happened to them was wrong. And so for Scarlett, she has a line in her diary where she says, "Oh, it's really funny, I keep on crying during sex and I don't understand why." And then she said to me, "You know, it was actually because I was raped and I didn't even realise that had happened." And another woman I spoke to who was raped by several pupils at a party when she was unconscious, she said it took her years to be able to understand that what had happened to her wasn't her fault. And actually something about the large number of young people who spoke out during Everyone's Invited, it was only then that she understood that it wasn't that she was this exceptionally bad person, that's why this had happened to her. It was like there's this really huge systemic problem and she was a victim of that.
And you actually speak to someone who is still a pupil at that school, don't you? And you hear about his own horrific experience, and just the idea of him continuing to go to school in that environment is one probably of the most shocking parts of this piece. Can you tell us a bit about him?
Yeah, so he is a sixth former at the school, and he said when he was in year 10, he was raped and threatened with a knife by an older boy. Well, he wanted to speak to me for several reasons, and one is to try to change the culture. Two is he wanted people to understand that not all of the victims are young girls, that there's also a culture of homophobia and boys are also victims of sexual assault. And sometimes it's even harder for them to speak out. He said that when it happened to him, he didn't know what he should do, but he also felt he couldn't tell a teacher because he said there's a snitches get stitches culture. And he thought that the support would be behind the perpetrator and not behind him if he did speak out.
And how did the school respond when you put these allegations to them?
They said that they have been working very hard to create a supportive culture, one that promotes equality and respect. They said they couldn't comment on specific allegations. And they also have, in light of the Ofsted downgrade, and there's been a threat to pull funding to that school, they have implemented a large number of reforms to try to address the problem. And I think one thing that is really important to emphasise is that this isn't a problem at one school. It really is nationwide.
Yeah, tell me a bit about that, because we want to get away from this idea that it's just one bad apple, one bad school. How widespread is it and how is that manifesting itself?
So the Everyone's Invited campaign in June submitted a list of schools that had been named by young people because of cases of sexual harassment, sexual abuse and sexism. And they ultimately named 3,000 schools, so around 1 in 10 schools in the country. And then Ofsted, in response to Everyone's Invited, commissioned a review of sexual abuse in schools, which actually just confirmed what the government has known for years, that sexual harassment is rife and it's accepted as a part of daily life in British schools, and that British students still feel that they're not being taught how to recognise if a relationship's abusive, they're not being taught about consent.
Right, okay. And so have they changed their standards now, and how is that working?
So one of the things that's happened is that this September, compulsory relationships and sex education has been rolled out through all schools. That was something that was recommended in a government report in 2016, and the implementation has been delayed for a year because of COVID. But the problem that lots of experts identified is that teachers have been saying they don't feel comfortable teaching this material. They want face-to-face training in it, and that hasn't happened. The Department for Education had estimated that it would cost between 18 million and around 59 million to roll out this new curriculum. And it told me it had spent 4 million.
Right. Wow. Okay. So that's a big gap.
Yeah, huge shortfall.
Which is worrying for the children who are involved in this kind of culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also not just about sex and relationships education. There are all kinds of other things that would be really helpful, like having school counsellors in every school, like having the whole school body trained on issues like equality and sexual consent, so that teachers know how to intervene in what are really emotionally fraught and complicated situations. It's really hard for teachers to be able to distinguish between all the different shades of grey that separate a misunderstanding from a criminal act. And I think one thing that young people understand very intuitively and very intimately, and that experts know, is that if you fail to address a really problematic culture, if you fail to address sexism and homophobia in the classroom, that's what creates the conditions for these really traumatizing and horrific acts of violence.
And a more open culture with more support for pupils in this kind of issue would probably avoid the flip side of the problem, which is perhaps schools getting police involved too quickly for these kind of matters, and that can have an impact on boys. You speak to a lawyer who says that they wouldn't want to be a boy in school right now because of that kind of knee-jerk response the other way.
Yeah, because what all experts are emphasising is they don't think a punitive response is helpful. They think that the focus should really be on victim support and on being able to identify and respond in a really sensitive and constructive way to unhealthy peer dynamics, unhealthy sexual behaviour in young people. So as you say, this fear about what kind of atmosphere we are creating for young boys is very much related to the fact that the government is not giving sufficient funding and making sufficient resources available to schools. Because also, if a young boy is exhibiting problematic behaviour, that can be a sign that something's not right at home, that they're themselves the victims, which is another reason that you do want teachers to be really responsive, to be picking up on this kind of thing and to be responding appropriately.
And of course, this means yet more pressure on teachers who have already been under incredible strain during the pandemic, and with many other services being underfunded, sort of picking up the slack for social services and other, you know, pupil referral services, for example. I mean, how can they expect to deal with this issue as well?
Yeah, absolutely. As so much of your reporting has shown, just how much strain teachers are under. And so it does come down to a funding problem. And ultimately, what lots of experts said was they really object to the fact that what's happened at the moment is we've developed a bit of a name and blame response. So Ofsted has said, in response to everything that's happened, schools should assume that they have a problem and they should be responding appropriately. And if they're not, then they're going to be downgraded as inadequate, which can have all kinds of really really terrible consequences. But the problem is that it's just not enough to be saying schools are rubbish, teachers are rubbish, without giving them the resources they need to fix the problem.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for exposing this story, Sophie. And I hope that we'll be reading more about it and how hopefully the situation improves in the months and years to come.
I really hope so, because I think that the positive from this is that I think a school can be a real driver for social change, that if we can address this problem, we might be able to really fix some very deep-seated cultural problems that we have throughout society. Thanks so much for having me on, Anoush.
Thank you. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues Alva Ray and Stephen Bush. We're produced by May Robson, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a nice review.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts?
Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.